I said, Rabbi Goodman needs no introduction.
Oh. Right. So then that's it. And that's it. That's the introduction.
They all know you. That's why they came.
Okay. So I just.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
It's wonderful to see. I'd like to thank Rabbi Hassan for being here. Now he's got to give his own shiur, which he's off to go give. Can the ladies in the executive club, can you all hear me over there? It's very nice. You know, there's a tea trolley here. And there's light refreshments, biscuits. They'll be coming around with duty free. I don't know. Obviously, you guys didn't get the gold tickets. You should have asked when you came in for the extra special, for an extra £5.
The upgrade.
Look at that. Look at that. VIP upgrade. There's Wi-Fi. You can always be kept. Can everyone at the back hear me? Everyone at the back, yeah. Okay. I've given out what is essentially additional material, which is not to do. So I should introduce myself for those people who haven't met me or anything. My name is Robert Mitchell Goodman. I direct Jewish education in Manchester, and I've been asked by Seed to give a pre-Purim talk to try to inspire us into more things on Purim. I've got three or four Purim type things which are all on the same theme, which are hidden messages in the Megillah. I've got three or four like this. This is part one of four, basically. That does not mean that I'm going to give two, three, and four to you. It's just the one that I'm starting with because it's usually the one that I start with. That is all. Does that make sense so far? Is everyone up to speed? Yeah? Okay, so I've been asked to speak by Rav Shai Grunfeld. He said, would you please come and address the Seed crew about something to do with Purim, something inspiring, just go for it. So, okay, I'll give it a go. See what happens. You may be inspired, you may not. You may think, oh, no, it's interesting. It could have gone out. Well, we'll see. Anyway, I've given out some sheets, which, don't worry, I'm not really going to be talking about that much. A lot of people often ask me questions about the Babylonian months and why Jewish months are called Babylonian Persian names. We're going to talk about the months of the year a bit. So all this is for advanced homework reading at home, which is where I've listed out all the Persian stroke Babylonian month names at the top and their quote-unquote Hebraicized translation at the bottom. So as you can see that they've got Nisanu, Ariu, Simanu, Duzu, Abu. Can you see that? So Abu, of course, is Av. Nisanu is Nisan. Can you see that? Right, okay. And we kind of translated that and pretty much kept those month names. Now, there is additional data in here as to how they organize their months, which you can read in your own time as to how they establish their months vis-a-vis how we establish our months. However, there is one thing at the bottom that I'd like to just go through with you. That's the very, very bottom paragraph, if anyone has access to the sheet. If you don't have access to the sheet, don't worry. It's almost completely irrelevant for what I'm going to talk about. So feel comfortable. It's all the way over there. It's all the way over there, aren't they? Okay, it doesn't matter. It's okay. I'll just shout out over there. Maybe we should have like a subtext title. Throw it like paper airplanes. Okay, the names of the months were adopted during the time of Ezra, after the return from the Babylonian exile. But we kept our versions of the Babylonian names to remind us that we were redeemed from the Babylonian exile, which is the first proper exile from Israel, and therefore we'll be redeemed in the future, just like we were redeemed then and we came back, so too we're going to be exiled from Israel and we're going to come back again. There's also meaning attached to the words that were given to the month numbers that are counted in the Chumash that remind us of particular times within that time. And that's really the key. The Torah only talks about months as a number. The third month from. The second month from, as it were. It's these Hebrew month names that we use. We don't call it the third month or the first month. We don't call it, you know, Tishrei month number one. Or, you know, we just don't do that. But we call it by name. The reason that we call it by name is there's something to do with that name which hints to us an illusion of something which is going on in that month. Now, was anyone here when I spoke last time in Seed? Is anyone a little bit of a show of hands? No, I don't know what you're talking about. You've never spoken to me before. It's the first time I've ever seen you. I don't know who you are. Is there anyone here that was here last time I spoke? What? Rosh Hashanah, the Erev Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, you were, yeah. It was just three people. Four people going up. Four at the back. Four. So we had four people. Okay. Last time I was here, I spoke about a timeline, the concept of a timeline. Do you remember that? Like a coil, a helix, right? And we said that if you have a helix, I don't have a prop for that. If you have a helix, and you put a line across an edge of the helix, every place on the spiral that you hit that line again has a certain energy, like an anniversary. Do you remember that for those people that were here from the previous one? Yeah? Okay. So we're going to talk similarly about that concept again, about the concept of a timeline to do with months. This time it's got Dukkha to do with months. Yeah? So far, so good? Okay. That was by means of an introduction. And with that in mind, I think we'll begin. So, I've introduced that, right? Okay. So, one of the main themes of what I want to talk to you tonight about, if you let me, is the fact that there are hidden messages in the written law. In the bits of the Torah that you read, it's covered and encrypted in hidden messages. Hidden. And unless you have the cipher, unless you're given the special codes as to how to kind of rejig what you're reading, you're going to miss almost all of the main data. Is that clear so far? That's the main bit. I've got to tell you a story, an anecdotal story, something that happened to me, in the old city of Jerusalem. Do you mind me talking about something that happened to me in Jerusalem? Is that okay? Anyone got any problems with that? In the executive section? You see, they're like upstairs in the jumbo jet. You have to hear from them on the radio. Okay. It's like this. Is anyone familiar with the Rambam Square in the old city of Jerusalem? Do you know when you're walking in the old city to go to the Kaisel, you go through a big, white, beautiful square. And there's a beautiful, now rebuilt synagogue, the Rambam Synagogue. But it used to be, in my old day, when I was in... It was just an arch. It was literally broken down and it hadn't been built. It's now been built. It's the most beautiful synagogue. Really, really stunning. Right opposite that synagogue, there's a section of payphones. That's getting really specific, right? And behind those payphones, there's an entrance to a yeshiva. Okay? Now, that yeshiva is a Kabbalistic yeshiva. Woo! That's a yeshiva. That's a good sound, wasn't it? That's a yeshiva where they sit around learning Kabbalah all day. Now, Kabbalah is the mystical, esoteric element of the Torah. Right? So they're really, really into all the kind of secret elements of the Torah. I was walking around and there were a couple of people standing outside who learnt in that yeshiva. Okay? And they were having a chat with each other. And I was there anyway, and I was hanging around anyway, waiting for someone. And I wasn't eavesdropping, but I was eavesdropping. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't actively eavesdropping, but I was just listening into their conversation with interest. I don't know what you would call that. But it wasn't. No, surely not eavesdropping. I would I. I was interested to hear what they say. These are the guys that learn a couple of things. What are they talking about? So they were talking to each other, and one said to the other, how are you doing? And they were talking about their chizuk and what they're doing during this particular time. And one guy says, well, you know, it's tough now during the months of Mur. So I said, oh, I wonder. And I couldn't, what I couldn't do was just tap them on the shoulder and say, excuse me, can't help but listen in. But could you just explain that to me? Because that would be exceptionally rude. Right, so just a little bit of a social thing for you. If that ever happens and someone says, don't actually tell me, go, excuse me, could you just explain to me what your conversation is? Probably best not to do that. Just saying that socially. Well, you can do what you want. Okay, years later, years and years later, I finally found out what they were talking about. And that's what I want to tell you about. I want to basically bring you up to speed with these two people's spied on conversation. Now that was worth coming for tonight, wasn't it? So it's got to be worth it, right? It's got to be worth it for that alone, right? Okay. So what we've got to do is get up to date with finding out what these two people were chatting about at the corner of the Rambam Square in the old city of Jerusalem. And once I'm up to speed, then we've got the shiur done. That's how it works. Yeah? All right. So let us begin. Are we all sitting comfortably? Craig, are you with me? Do you feel...
Yes.
That was such a qualified... Do you want to go... Are you with me? Are you here?
I'm walking by your side of the...
Okay, all right. I got... Can I hold my hand?
You might go ahead
for
a minute.
Whatever you need, Craig. You just... Okay, you need to... by the way, policy is any questions, put your hand up and we'll go through it as we go, okay? That's policy. I can always say no, I'm not going to answer it, but I will try to answer it if I can. Okay? All right, here we go. two things. Got to start off with two things. Thing number one. The word Megillah, which means scroll, basically, comes from a Hebrew word Megaleh, which means to reveal. So Megillah means it's coming to reveal something. There's an incredible Talmud Yerushalmi, that's the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud was written 150 years earlier than the Babylonian Talmud, and it was written in Tiberias, for money in Tiberias, and it was called the Jerusalem Talmud out of deference to the Holy City, but it's actually written in Tiberias. 150 years later, Ravina and Ravashi compiled the Babylonian Talmud in Persia, it was now Persia kind of thing, Babylonia, and that became the definitive Talmud. But there's a Talmud Yerushalmi in the 10th Perek of Kesubos, which says that after the Mashiach comes, all we will have is the Chumash, which is the five books of Moshe, and Megillas Esther. That's it. That's all you get. And all of Nach won't be necessary. All of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, anything else, excuse me, outside of the Chumash, will not be necessary. So we can just drop everything else, keep one Sefer Torah, one Megillas Esther, and everything else is cool. Make things easier on your bookshelf. Bookshelves after the Messiah will be lighter, it seems. You heard it here. Don't invest in too many bookshelves because Sheikh is coming and we don't really need that. Sorry, I'm not working for the local bookshelf market there. How does that work? How does it work? How can the Gemara and Kesubos say, actually, we won't need anything else except for the Megillah? The Megillah and the Chumash, and he got it all in there. That must mean there's probably more data in the Megillah than you give it credit for. Possibly. Would you agree with that? Does that sound, Craig, would you agree with that?
Yes,
I agree. Thank you very much. I like it when he agrees with me. That's it. There must be something going on with the Megillah that I have missed in order to be able to understand what that statement is saying. I'd like to give you some examples in the Torah where it says stuff but doesn't discuss it. Can anyone think of any examples in the Torah where the Torah discusses something and doesn't actually says, you know, you should do this, but doesn't tell you what it is or how you should do it? Tefillin! Brilliant! Absolutely excellent. Was that what you were going to say as well? You were pointing over there to tefillin. Excellent. Tefillin! So what is it? What the Torah is extremely oblique about. It mentions tefillin four times. It says you should bind them on your eyes and it should be a totafos between your eyes. It doesn't tell you what totafos is and doesn't tell you between your eyes are. Now, where would you say between your eyes are, by the way? Everyone's going like that, aren't they? And ladies, where would you say we don't do that because we're executive. So between your eyes is like that, right? And what's a totafos anyway? What does totafos mean? It's not clear, right? Does it tell you they're black? Does it tell you they're square? Does it tell you have to put on straps? Does it tell you what they look? It doesn't say anything, right? How do we all know? If you go to Yemen, they're exactly the same tefillin as you go. If you go to Eretz Israel, if you go to Johannesburg, and if you go to Chile, they're all the same tefillin. You notice that? They're all the same. Where do we get that culture from? How do we know that? I have this terrible habit of going off. Do we know how long we've got? We've got 1 hour, right? Do you know how long we got? Can I go off a little bit, please? Yeah, did you mind? I know, because I know people don't want to take too long. Whew, not too long, right? I know that. I know that people, sorry, but I'm going to go off. Well, it didn't take me long, did it? It was like 5 minutes in. He hardly stayed on topic tonight. How was it? Oh, I don't know. He talked about ducks. I'm sorry. Okay, here we go. You should know, when the Torah talks, it talks in its own language. It doesn't talk in your language. It talks in its language. And it's our job to understand what it's talking about. It gives us a dictionary in the oral law to understand the written law's statements. But what it says in the written law is not necessarily what you would have understood. Leon, you came up with tefillin, right? It's a really good example. And other people, I think, also were thinking about tefillin as well. Can I just talk to you about eyes? Would you mind? It's like, no, well, we're kind of scared of you. Just do it already. Okay, all right, I'll say it then, glazed eyes. It's like this, what are eyes? Okay, so people, what are eyes? How would you define an eye?
Something that you see with.
Elaine, that was awesome. Eye, no, really, that's pretty good. People are going to say, it's all business. It's got to have an optic nerve, and it's got to have an iris, it's something you see with. That was perfect. Actually, maybe, can I pick on Elaine? Elaine. What is something, what parts,
seriously, yeah.
What do you see with? When you see, what do you see with?
light hits the back of the eye.
Right, and
etc.
Would anyone say there's anything more you see with? So point one, we've got these like blobs in our skull hair, these round bits, and light goes in it, and we call those eyes. So that we can call eyes. Would you say that's all you see with?
Your brain
has to make sense of that data, right? Your brain has to make sense of that data. Isn't that awesome? So, do you know which part of your brain deals with that data? The occipital lobe, that's right, Elaine. Best again, Elaine, this is awesome. Can you just show me again where you did that? That's right, Elaine's got it right. Nobody in the executive club class did they? You better get your act together on your comfy couches. That's right, it's this part of the brain. The back of the brain is the occipital lobe. Mark, are you with us?
I'm taking notes.
Really?
Yeah.
How studious.
Thank you.
Awesome. Okay, so the back of the brain is the occipital lobe. Craig, are you with me on this? So the bit that processes light data is over here. And the bit that allows us in to the light is here. Are you with me so far? Now the tyro, when it means eyes, means what Elaine said. Eyes are something you see with. And the bits of your body that you see with are hair. I'm pointing for the tape. I'm pointing to my eyes. And hair. I'm pointing to my occipital lobe at the back of my brain for the tape. This is not in video vision. So where are eyes? Our eyes are here. The light comes in there and gets processed there. So where's between your eyes? Here. Here between your eyes. Because the Tyra is talking about eyes. This is not between your eyes, that's your brow ridge. That's the top of your nose. You would have said, the top of your nose. But it says, put the fill in on the top of your nose. It's the erated reform version of the Tyra. Put the fill in on the top of your nose and feel comfortable and good about who you are. But over here, this is where your eyes are. And the Torah says, bein einecha, between your eyes. This is one eye area. This is another eye area. So the tefillin should sit in between the eye area. While I'm here, any optometrists or eye people here? Any eye specialists? Any people into eyes?
They're away.
All your local optometrists are away. Sometimes you get people who work as opticians and they're here, and it's really interesting. I'm going off. I did say I was going off. I told you I was going off. The knot of the tefillin sits where? On the head. So I know, ladies, it's okay. Don't worry, I know it's just like not a tefillin thing, but it's like, oh, we don't wear tefillin. But the knot is over here. And that's such an interesting thing. Did you know? This is fascinating. This is an often misunderstood concept. Most people think that the left eye goes to the right-hand side of the brain and the right eye goes to the left-hand side of the brain. Have you heard that?
Yes.
That the eyes cross over. It's actually not quite like that. The left-hand side of each eye goes to the right-hand side of the brain and the right-hand side of each eye goes to the left-hand side of the brain. So half of each eye is split in half and then goes to the opposite brain half. And if you've ever looked at your image in a spoon, you ever looked in your spoon?
Yeah.
And it's upside down, have you noticed that? So the back of your eye is the same shape, right? So what you're seeing is technically upside down. So half of an upside down image goes that way, and half of another upside down image goes there. Then it has to meet in your brain. The brain has to put the image together, then turn it the right way up and make sense out of it. Are you with me? Is everyone with me? Yeah? Yeah, no, someone isn't. No, what's wrong? Are you with me? No, we are. We're too luxurious to be with you. Sorry, I said. It's like you're going to get one of those seats that does this. You know what I mean? Oh, it's nicer, isn't it? Press the button. Now, notice the knot of the tefillin. The knot of the tefillin. Let's follow. If you look at the leather straps of the top of the tefillin, they follow the optic nerves from the back of the eye exactly round and meet at the point of the brain where the nerves connect. And we knot the leather straps there. This is awesome, this bit. The strap from the left-hand side of the brain is knotted and comes down the right-hand side of the body. And the strap from the right-hand side of the brain comes down, goes through the knot, and comes down to the left-hand side of the body. Just like your eyes do that. That's how they're rigged. You'll notice I've got a Tatura and Grab a Whiskey, Principles of Anatomy and Physiology, Volume 8, small edition, pocket size here, which we're going to refer to later for something. But the tefillin are actually designed as a mirror of the system of the human eye. Notice we said that each eye is split into two, right? Left-hand side goes to the right-hand side of the brain. Right-hand side goes to the left hand. How many parts of the eye then are there in the front? Sorry? Four. How many compartments are there in the head to fill in? Four. Two on this side, two on that side. And both of them have shins going in different directions to split them up. So two go that way, two go this way. It's an absolute mirror of your nervous system. That was what it means, between your eyes. That's the concept of between your eyes. The Torah means eyes. It doesn't mean these. It means eyes, the way the Torah sees it. So put it between your eyes and it will follow the whole system to do with your eyes. In fact, the whole thing about them is actually sitting directly over the optic nerve, then meeting at the optic chiasmata where they join, then shifting one down one side, one down the other side. And it matches your neural system. I went off. Sorry about that. That wasn't meant to. Yes, Leon.
And this was all known
3,327 years ago.
Doctors or
and sorry, in fact, before that, the Jews wore tefillin before they came out of Egypt. But they didn't have all the parashas in yet, because they hadn't yet got out. And the parashas that we put in the tefillin are talking about the Exodus. So they had deficient tefillin. They wore what we would call non-kosher tefillin. But they wore as much as they could at the time. Fascinating concept. Ben Zuma talks about that. What were the tefillin the Jews wore in Egypt? Fascinating concept.
That is impossible to be a coincidence.
We're not talking about... I don't think it's a coincidence. It's, remember, whether they knew about the neural system is irrelevant. That's how God dictated how he wanted it. And that was a tradition. The point was, it doesn't say any of that in the Torah. It just says, put it between your eyes. And it leaves to the oral law all the data. Are you with me so far? Basically, the uncles... Okay, that was tefillin. Whew, we did tefillin. Bing. That was number one. Can anyone think of anything else that's written in the Torah which says do this or do that and then just leaves you in the dark as to what's going on? Whew, there's a lot there. Okay, sorry, what? Hello? What? Just say it again. Ooh, shut the word. It tells us it's shutness. It's wooden linen. Yeah, okay. It says don't wear shutness. It doesn't tell you that it's wooden linen. That's true. Okay. Shabbos is very oblique. Very, very oblique. And it leaves that almost all to the aura. But it actually says certain things that we have no idea what they are. We don't even know what they are. It just says do this. Have you ever... any examples? Johnny? No? Oh, yeah. But, sorry? Well, Luluf is quite explicit. It says take this species, this species, this species, and this species, so we know what they are. So we actually can go and get those. That's actually quite explicit. But something close to Luluf, can you think of something close to Luluf where it doesn't define it? So it says dwell in a sukkah for 7 days. What's a sukkah? Oh. Could be anything, right? Dwell in a sukkah for 7 days. What's a sukkah? Doesn't tell you. It's a booth. Get in a booth. What's a booth? And we've got a whole masakta called booths. Called sukkah, right? Which tells us what a booth is. It's a lot of work. I mean, it's you go into a booth, you'll go anywhere in the world and find a Jewish community anywhere in the world, they've all got something which you would recognise as a sukkah. It's got certain dimensions, certain number of walls, has to have a certain kind of ceiling, has to be built in a certain kind of way, and the Torah doesn't say any of it. He says, do it in a sukkah. Do it in a sukkah. A mikveh. You got the kind God has got to a booth and a mikveh. What's a mikveh? I'm not telling you. And you won't find it anywhere in the Chumash. It just doesn't tell you. This is my favourite. My absolute favourite. It's in Devarim Yud Beis Chof Aleph, which is Deuteronomy 12:21. This is my favourite. Hashem commands the people to slaughter animals, and he says, as I have commanded you. Now, unless you want to get on the argument saying, well, we don't have the whole Torah, which is heretical. okay, because we do. And there's a whole separate schmooze I've got about, do we have the whole tour, have we lost any bits? Maybe someone came along and added something, maybe someone took something away. I've got a whole schmooze on that. Bottom line is, we do have the whole tour. You just have to trust me on that one, unless you want to sit through another hour and a half of me wittering on about the fact that we do. Okay, so we really, really do. And it says that you're going to shecht this animal, you're going to slaughter the animal the way I've told you. But nowhere in the Torah does it tell us how to shecht. It doesn't tell us how to slaughter an animal. There's a whole tractate called Chulin, which does. That's how you have to learn how to kill an animal. But the Torah says, I told you about this, now go do it. But nowhere, you won't find anywhere where it says, take the animal, it has to be cut like with a really, really sharp knife as opposed to a large club, or you have to play music like Eurovision Song Contest until it just dies out of boredom. It's, you know what I mean? It's just, it isn't like that. I don't know. Yeah, I've got to come back. I've got to come back to it. But you get the idea. The point is, there are lots and lots and lots of places in the written Torah that you frankly don't have any understanding of what he's talking about until you go to the oral Torah, which illuminates it. Oh, this, and this. And that was also given over to Moshe Rabbeinu Mount Sinai, but orally. So it's like, this, I'm telling you what this means. Now, here's the shorthand notes, like the secretarial notes. This is in the Chumash. The Chumash is like the shorthand notes for Shas. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, when he would listen to the Torah being laid, he would hear all the Masechtas of Gemara coming out of each pasuk. He would say the whole thing's just shorthand notes. Often between aliyahs, he would make a Masechta, he would make a siyum, a completion, an entire Masechta, in between aliyahs. So they used to serve him. Right, but he realized that the whole Torah was just shorthand notes for the oral law. I have a background training in genetics. And when I was studying genetics, I always talk about this. People who come to my show know what I'm going to say. Oh, here he goes. He's going to talk about things about the genes. I always say this. When I started off in university, we used to call spare genes that aren't used junk genes. Has anyone heard of this? Junk genes? The vast majority of the genes in our human body don't make the human body. For people that haven't heard me witter on about this for years, do you know how much of our genetic material actually makes our body? So if you look at the genetic material, and you know there's genes inside the cells and they command the body to make things. How much of that is necessary to make a body? Come on, people. 50%. Enjoy hearing about 50%. 1%? Wow, that's tight. No, it's not 1%. It's not 50% either, though. Any guesses? 20% of the human genetic material is making a body. No, it's not 20%. Go on, 18. Oh, we're getting closer. Anyone else? 10. Oh, warm.
7.
Warmer?
It's 2.
Very warm.
5.
Also very warm.
4.
Nearly. 3! 3! That's amazing. 3%. 3% of your genetic material makes every single thing in your whole body. Everything
What are all the extra genes?
When I started university doing genetics, they said, well, they're junk genes. They're just, you know, genes we picked up since we were fish. And we don't need them anymore, so we just kind of carry them around. By the time I graduated, they had changed their tune. And they started calling it non-encoding genetic material. That's a slight way of saying, maybe it's not junk. Maybe it's not junk. Maybe there's more to it than we originally thought. We only need 3%, we found 3%, so the rest of it we can just delete. Well, we can make a body out of 3%, so forget the whole thing. The Kabbalah teaches that in that 97% is encoded the bottom of the soul. The animal soul, it's a physical thing, and it is encoded in that 97%. The Kabbalah teaches that. The Arizal talks about it, and he talks about when cells split, there are letters inside the cells which join up into divine names. Have you ever seen a picture of a chromosome? Do you know what they look like? Little alephs. They call them X's. It's an aleph, and a yud is a Y. What's the letter of masculinity in Torah? What letter makes something masculine? Yud. Yuds and alephs. And they split up. It's unbelievable. I can't begin to tell you this stuff. That's a whole separate shmooze. But all of that is brought in the Kabbalah Zero! Mind blowing!
This concept of the junk genes, people have in their minds when they read the Tyra. They feel as if much of the Tyra that they read is junk genes. It's all the junk genes, right? You read the Tyra, open the Tyra, God made the world, it was very, very nice. Let's cut to the chase!
There's a bloke called Avraham, he had lots of kids, who cares how many? They went to Egypt, they came out, we can make the whole Tyra very thin, like pamphlet Tyra, expurgated Tyra.
Tyra cut to the chase, stuff we really need to know. Dump almost all of Bereishis. You know what I mean? Who needs all that stuff? I need to know about Avimelech going and what? They dug wells. Who cares? Who cares? Get on with the chase, right? We went to Egypt, we came out, then we got into Israel. There's a lot of things in between. But bottom line, we get Israel.
I guess we've got like 4 or 5 pages. 3% of the Tyra. What's all the other 97%? You with me so far? You awake? You're doing well. You're doing very well. I don't know how much we're going to get done here, but give it a go.
The real point of this evening is that often you go to shul or you go to a shir and you read some pasukim and it's just bonkers. It's just meaningless kind of drivel. And you're just thinking, what is all this?
Something I'd like to change your attitude about is maybe there's more. Maybe. Maybe there's more. I'd like to read one of these junk genes with you. A junk gene. Can I read a junk gene? I read a junk gene. A gene you don't need to know about. Yeah?
I assume everyone is at least conversant with the story of Purim. There's a man called Mordechai, there's a woman called Esther, and there were two really, really nasty protagonists called Ahasuerus and Haman. And they didn't like the Jews very much. Okay? They really didn't. And Baruch Hashem, one thing led to another, and the Jews got saved from the plot, let's eat. That's basically Purim. Are you with me so far? I mean, that's Amos, right? That's the bottom line. That's really true, right? There's a meal, and we drink a little bit. Ooh, it's a nice night. Everyone's very happy. And basically, the bottom line is we got out of shtuch. Right, that's really the bottom line, right? I mean, I'm just being totally straight with you, right? That's what most people... So I don't need much more day than that. How much more do you need than that? In fact, the truth is, what I've just said there, it's like 101 Purim, right? If you're coming to Judo and say, what's Purim? What I just said. It was a bit of a problem and we got over it. It was a big miracle, whatever. We drink a lot, it's have a great night. That's it. That's Purim. Some people dress up. You with me so far? Craig.
Still there.
We'll see. Okay, just keep hanging in there.
Yeah, some of the data that's given over in the Megillah. It's about a beauty pageant, where Ahasuerus decides to kill his queen in a fit of rage, and now needs a new queen. So they go around looking for all the pretty girls in the city, and they kidnap him, as you do, and you take him to a harem, and you present him in a beauty pageant to the king. And whichever pretty girl the king likes the most, he gets to marry as the queen. And the rest of those poor girls get to stay for the rest of their lives in a harem. And they can never go back to the family because they're now chattels of the king. But if you're the lucky girl and you get chosen, you get to be the empress of the known world and your children become kings and emperors. And if you don't, it's pretty rough. Yeah? We're playing for keeps, those girls, okay? They're playing for keeps. Can I read you some material here? Can you focus? Yeah? In English, Megillah, second chapter. There we go. I'm jumping in at verse 8. This is chapter 2, verse 8. So it came to pass, when the king's bidding and decree were published, and when many young girls were being brought together to Shushan the capital and the charge of Haggai, that Esther was taken into the palace by force. They found her, she was in hiding, under the charge of Haggai, guardian of the women. The girl pleased him. He said, oh, she's nice. I bet the king will like her. And she obtained his kindness. And he hurriedly prepared her cosmetics and allowance of delicacies to present her, along with the 7 special maids from the palace that each girl got. And he transferred her and her maidens, so she had her group of... Notice she had 7. So she assigned one to each day of the week so she could figure out what day Shabbos was. And he transferred her and her maidens to the best quarters in the harem. They were like, grade 1 rooms and grade not as good rooms.
Esther had not told of her people or her kindred. She didn't tell anyone she was Jewish, for Mordechai had instructed her not to tell. Every day Mordechai used to walk about in front of the court of the harem to find out how Esther was doing, about her well-being, what would become of her. Now, this is verse 12. When each girl's turn arrived to come to the king Ahasuerus, after having been treated according to the manner prescribed for women for 12 months, for so was the prescribed length of their anointing accomplished. 6 months with oil of myrrh, which by the way is an oil extracted from a tree resin, and 6 months with perfumes and feminine cosmetics. Thus the girl came to the king. She was given whatever she requested to accompany her from the harem to the palace. In the evening she would come, and the next morning she would return to the second harem. Those are the girls that had already met the king, in the custody of another chamberlain, guardian of the concubines. And she would never again go to the king unless the king desired her and summoned her by name. Do I need to know that to have the Purim that I just discussed? Do I need to know that? Not at all. I think you can set that aside as junk genes. Right? What do I need to know that for? I need to know oil of myrrh and feminine cosmetics and, you know, who cares? No, I'm just saying there's a beauty pageant, there's a lot of girls and he picked Esther. Get cut to the chase, right? Who needs all this, right? You're wasting space, wasting ink. You've got to understand, the Megillah was a public document that was written right after the actual event happened by Mordechai with the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the men of the Great Assembly, and it was read by Ahasuerus. It was mamish to be read like a public letter. In fact, today, when we read the Megillah, we have to read the Megillah folded flat on a table like a newspaper. Because that's how it was read in the time of Persia. That's actually how it was read. They read it out like a letter. So Ahasuerus had to read it too. He had to read this. Now, who hated the Jews more? Haman or Ahasuerus? Haman. Our sages tell us it was 50-50. They were as bad as each other. Ahasuerus was a man that had a huge pile of dirt that he didn't know what to do with, and Haman came along with a ditch and said, throw it in here. That's how Ahazal teaches about it. He was as happy to get rid of the Jews as Haman was to come up with a final solution. He was as wicked and as anti-Semitic as Haman. But the problem is, Ahasuerus survived, and he had to read this. So we couldn't say that. We had to hide it in between the lines. Because he had to read this and see that he was a good guy, right? Otherwise he'd be very upset with the Jews. So he'd have to read this whole thing. What do I need to know about 6 months and 6 months? Just say to me, they went to beauty parlour for 12 months. Gentlemen here, can I just, hold on. Could you imagine the bill at the end of that?
Can we just try?
A year, you'd be fine. a year. You don't even come out, a year of beauty parlour. Could you imagine that? Imagine the bill at the end. There were thousands of women. Could you imagine the cost of keeping thousands of women in a year-long beauty parlour? With anything they wanted. Any specific diet she had from a particular area, if that's how she grew up needing it, was shipped in from wherever so she could be comfortable and happy.
What's changed?
What's changed? I don't know. It depends what ladies you know. But wow, it's pretty intense. What do I need Shisha Chadoshim for Shisha Chadoshim for? 6 months and 6 months. The Gemara Megillah on page 13a explains how the beauty treatment was split up. There was a two-stage beauty treatment. The first stage beauty treatment was a six-month skin softening treatment. 6 months, people. Not 6 days, 6 months, where they would anoint these oils and make their skin absolutely shining and radiant. And that also, by the way, worked as an exfoliant and depilator. The thing where the hair comes out. How do you say it?
Depilator.
Depilatory? How do you say it?
Depilator.
An epilator. Isn't that a machine?
Yeah.
No, it's, I don't know, what is it called? What, there's two things. There's one where you move the hair, there's one is where you pull the hair up by the root.
Depilation.
Have we got that? Have I said it wrong? I'm just going to carry on. There's something going on in the executive club lounge. Is it what is it called?
It's a different cheer.
It's a different... Let's talk about that next year, okay, people? All right. Why do I need such in-depth information about how this woman was treated for 6 months? 6 months. Could it have just said they went through the process of beautification, finished? The Vilna Gaon, about any other Kramer of Vilna, the famed Vilna Gaon, says, you know what? To understand these verses, you need a Zohar Kodesh. The Zohar Kodesh, the Zohar, the holy mystical sefer, the written oral law of the Kabbalah, written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, he comes and talks about this. And he says like this, this is what you need to know. This, I'm going to bring you up to speed, okay? This is how it's going to work. It's like this. You're going to need the cipher. Remember I told you there's junk genes and stuff like that, but really it's not junk genes? What we need is the cipher. You need the special code. He says like this. Whenever you hear the term Na'ara, maiden, in the Megillah, it means soul. Whenever you hear the term Melech, king, it means Hashem. Interesting. Interesting. That's a cipher. That's a special secret code. When the Megillah, now obviously it's not taking away the actual basic meaning that women did go through 6 months and 6 months. But when you read it on a deeper level, the level that Mordechai encoded in it to teach us about it, that Ahasuerus did not understand when he read it publicly, the word Na'ara means soul. The word maiden means soul. Often the soul is referred to in the feminine. Neshama, soul, has a hay on the air. It's a feminine thing. With me so far? We got this piece of paper with the months. Yeah? Just skip to the Hebrew bit. Where it says, halfway down the page, the Hebrew calendar says Tishrei, and it goes through to Elul. It's like this. You can split up the 12 months of the Hebrew calendar into two groups of 6 months. Okay? You can cut through from Mar Cheshvan through to Adar Sheni, is 6 months. And then halfway through Nisan, all the way through to the end of El, is another 6 months, culminating with Tishrei. So you get basically, you pretty much chop it up into two groups around 6 months. Are with me so far? Very interesting. Let's talk about this. What's the myrrh and the perfumes? He said for 6 months, they were anointing with oil of myrrh, and 6 months, they were putting on perfume. That's a lot of time to perfume yourself, ladies. That's a long time. 6 months. It's a long time. What's going on? Mar Cheshvan to Adar, base, those 6 months, those were the months of myrrh. And then from Nisan through to Tishrei, those were the months of cosmetics and perfumes. What's going on? So the 6 months of myrrh, what's myrrh? The oil was used as a depilatory agent, did I say that correctly? Depilatory, which means to remove hair. The plain meaning is that the women used it to become more glabrous. I'll say that one more time. Glabrous. That's not glamorous. It's glabrous, which means hairless. Hairlessness is known as glabrousness. I just thought I'd throw that out. You look, you learn something every evening. If you get anything out of this, did you know the word glabrous? It's a good Scrabble word, by the way, especially if you get triple word. You know, you try. I've got, oh. Now's the time for me to refer to the Tatura and Grab a Whiskey, Principles of Anatomy and Physiology, 8th edition, pocket size. This is awesome. This book is written by people who are desperate, desperate to prove the function of everything in the human body and how it fits with the theory of evolution. Desperate. These people are desperate, you understand me? They've got to make it fit, because this is the world philosophy. I'm now going to turn to page 133, 132, where it talks about fingernails. Look at this. It's the anatomy and physiology of fingernails. Look at that. That's a cross-section of a human fingernail there with a cuticle and the nail body and the dermis and the nail bed. It's profound, but you can look at it later. And he talks about nails. And he says like this. He's listen to this. These are top physiologists. How to use it in the first year of uni. Says like this. Functionally, nails help us grasp small objects and allow us to scratch various parts of the body. That's as good as he could do. That's it. That's what he says. That's it. That's why they're there. That's why they evolved. That's why we get them. Because you can pick up things and you can scratch various parts of your body. Which, of course, you couldn't do without nails, right? Interesting. He has a tremendous thing about hair in here as well. While we're talking about hair, he talks about hair, which I think is just phenomenal. He says regarding hair, if I can find it. Where is it? I forgot the page. He talks about hair as well. And he says hair is primarily functioned. It's what? Because it talks about function of hair. Terrence, where is it? I wish I could read it to you. I've got it here. He says, you're going to have to trust me. I can look at it later. Hair is even better. He says hair, its main function is protective, although the protection offered is limited. Now, for everything else, he talks about the heart, the nerves, there's function. He goes into it. Hair is protective from a physiological kind of point of view, although it's limited protection. I'll give you that. And that's it. That's what they could get for nails and hair. That's it in the textbooks, which they will take. The Zohar Kodesh, in volume 3, page 134b, says as follows. Every single thing a Kodesh Baruch Hu created, everything, leeches, mites, giant squid, lemons, everything has a purpose. Except for hair and nails. Hair and nails don't have any purpose. Indeed, it's the only part of our body we regularly amputate. You think about that? Could you imagine, like, your elbows keep growing too long? You have to go to the elbow barber, you know, grinding it down with, like, an angle grind. How would you like it to this? It's like these magazines with the latest elbow styles. Oh, I really like that one. You know, sparks going off. It's like, what are you going to get my elbows done this week? Oh, is it just too long, aren't they? People on the trainer are like, poking them and stuff. You don't go around amputating parts of your body regularly, but you do go to the entire shop, people who make livings, chopping off these parts of your body. That's how they make their living. What do? I amputate. If an alien came down from Thraga, what do? I trim off people's fingertips. And then I paint the rest. It's crazy. You ever thought about that? Even the physiologists will tell you stuff is useless. They can't figure out a use. Are you with me? Is this making any sense? You've lost the point. Elaine, we're coming back to it now. Thank you for bringing me back to it, though. Because I could keep doing this all night. Hey, Faye. We said that they're functionless. I want to talk about two... Oh. I do apologise, Elaine. I'll be getting back to the point soon. Has a purpose, except for hair and nails.
But isn't that a contradiction?
No, there's an exception. Hashem created everything with a purpose except for hair and nails. Are you asking why Hashem would make something without a purpose?
Yeah.
That is just what I want to talk about. Is everyone... I know, we're working really hard here. We're working hard. Ruby, you with me? Ruby, you good? Craig, everyone here? Yeah, focused. Here we go. We're going to get to the punchline now. There are two Yetzer Horrors. Two separate evil inclinations within us as human beings. Okay? Evil inclination, number one, I would like to dub the cold Yetzer Horror. And the Yetzer Horror number two, I would like to dub the hot Yetzer Horror. Cold Yetzer Horror is kind of says, couldn't be bothered. Don't want to do it. I'm too tired. I'm so tired. Couldn't be bothered. That is the cold Yetzer Horror. The cold Yetzer Horror's job is to stop you from doing positive mitzvahs. Build a sukkah. Oh, so much to do. I'd have to start lugging all these benches and chairs. And I've got to pack all the stuff. Oh, I'm so tired.
Recognisable at all?
Hot Yetzer Hara. Hot Yetzer Hara is the Yetzer Hara which comes along to incite you to do negative mitzvahs.
Don't have the pork sandwich, says God.
Oh, but the pork sandwich is brilliant. Go get one, go get one. They're cheap at Tesco's now on rye with low-fat mayonnaise. Even your dietitian will be happy. Oh, maybe I should go get one. That's actively taking you away to do something to do. Are you with me?
Hot and cold. The cold month. Why are there seasons of winter and summer? He holds up a magic sheet.
There's a cycle of the months, right? And you go from Mar Cheshvan all the way through to Tishrei. And generally the Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevah, Shvat, Adar is kind of cold. It gets cold on this side, then it kind of warms up over here. Okay, half the month is a bit colder, half the month's a bit hotter.
Yeah, I'm not making that up, right? Rabbi's making it all up, right?
The cold time, what do we do during the cold time? During those months, there's not much to do. There's not much to do. That's when you do the moisturising. The cold months are the time to work on curbing your desires. That's what they're there for. Hashem designed the cold months to cool you down. Your heat, the hot desires, the hot Yetzer Hara is nullified or kind of suppressed a bit during the cold environment. Hashem helps us by reducing the ambient temperature. And this affects the positive side later, which we'll get to. But in spring, we're happier. We're happy to do positive mitzvahs because it's warmer and the environment's happier. Have you noticed most of the positive mitzvahs that we're told to do happen in the warmer months? Have you noticed that? What's an interesting thing? Most of the positive mitzvahs, like making a sukkah, keeping pace with all that stuff, that happens when it's warmer. It's not freezing cold.
Is it different where you live?
Oh, it's got to be in the Northern Hemisphere. Jews are designed only to live in the Northern Hemisphere. No, I mean that. Living in the Southern Hemisphere is post facto, because the words of our prayers and everything has to follow Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is in the Northern Hemisphere. That means we have to say the Saint Alamata Levrocha, and we have to say Mashi Faruchah Mori Degeshim in our prayers, according to what it's like in Jerusalem. Which means if you live in South Africa, you have to daven for the rain in the middle of the summer. If you live in Buenos Aires, you have to daven for the Saint Alamata Levrocha when it doesn't fit, because you have to go with what's going on in the Northern Hemisphere. Jews were designed to be in Israel. The fact we're in exile, what on earth are we doing in Salford and Bury? No, really, think that through. That's right, yeah, I'm totally with you. What on earth are we doing in Salford? That really, we've literally been scattered to Khanfei Haaretz, literally to the whole corners of the earth. But we're not designed to be there. We were designed to be we're Middle Easterners. That's a real design. Unfortunately, we've been spread over the earth because of our behaviour. We're trying to repatriate ourselves. Yeah? Now, the myrrh was a depilatory. It was first used to remove hair. What does hair symbolise? We just said that even the textbooks can't give you a decent thing on hair. Hair is something intrinsically useless. Nails are something which are pretty much useless, unless you wish to scratch various parts of your body with that particular tip of that finger, according to Turn Rubber Whiskey, in which case they're kind of useful. Doesn't hair keep you warm? If you look, with respect, okay, I've got a question coming from the executive club class that says, doesn't hair keep you warm? Yes, okay, doesn't it? If you lost all the hair on your forearm, I see that you're very well clad in like leather and wool and yum. Would you really go, oh, hypothermia, body shutting down? It's that you've got clothing. Okay, it keeps you warm a very little bit, but generally it's not particularly functional. They didn't even say it keeps you warm, they said it gives you protection, although it is limited at best. I don't know how much hair on your arm gives you protection, but I guess it does a bit. Now, for 6 months these women were taking off their hair. Now when we said, what's a woman, what's a maiden? Come on everybody, all together please for me. The soul! The soul spends 6 months exfoliating and depilating. Oh, I don't know how to say it. You know what I mean.
It's taking off its hair. What is hair?
Everything extraneous in your life. Do I really need that phone upgrade? Is it vital for me to purchase alloy wheels?
Is that kitchen unit absolutely necessary? It's £700 before fitting.
Do I need that for my life?
Do I need to get my teeth veneered? Is that really absolutely necessary? 6 months you got. 6 months to work on that when it's cold. You don't have anything else to do, Major. She can think about that. You're not busy. What else are you doing? Ain't like you're making yontif. You got 6 months to think about that in life. 6 months or so left to think about that. During the cold months, where the cold Yotaro is like, oh, I couldn't be bothered. Oh, fine, so sit at home and think about what you actually really need. That's the soul's job for 6 months. In spring, when we're happy, we heat up. We're busy, we start with yontif.
Absolute bane of many women at the moment is that in just a few weeks it's Pesach.
There's so much to do. Now during that time where there's so much to do, you can't sit around thinking, do I need the phone upgrade? You need to clean the house. There's a lot to do. You need to get matzahs. And then there's yontif. And then there's Tishrei, which the whole month just disappears in a yontif. You know, basically October, whatever it is, just goes. There is no month. It's just like yontif, 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 right? It's not very evenly spread. Those 6 months are the 6 months of applying perfume.
That's where you actively take something external and the soul applies perfume to beautify itself for its husband. Can you hear that?
6 months of removing that which you don't need, then you've got 6 months of doing stuff actively to make yourself beautiful.
Do you hear this?
The perfumes understood by the Gra to be positive mitzvahs having an effect to beautify our soul to the Creator. But it also says Tamrukei Hanoshim, cleansers. Even during that 6 months, they were given cleansers. Why do you need cleansers? Because you always need to keep clean.
The soul always needs to keep clean for Hashem. But the main focus in one group of 6 months is get rid of the junk in your life. The stuff which is holding you back. The stuff which is preventing you from growing. Then you've got 6 months. Do stuff for me. Make me a Pesach. Make me a Shavuos. Make me a Yom Tov. Do stuff. Bring people over. Have a good time. Be communal. You haven't been doing that for 6 months. You've been thinking about yourself for 6 months. Now for 6 months, think about the whole community. To be part of the community for 6 months. Then go back and wind in. It's just coming to me now. By the way, 6 months, 6 months. You know, in Shabbos Mincha, we split up the 6 months. At Mincha, we say either Baruchi Nafshi or we say Pirkei Avos at Mincha. You heard of that? At Mincha, the men sit down and they say, Baruchi Nafshi, you say in the cold months. In the cold months, when you're taking off all that, you can feel like kind of like, oh. You say Baruchi Nafshi to warm you up a bit. You say some Tehillim to keep you going through that dark time. Then when it's summer and you're bouncing around and you're happy, you can lose it a bit. You can overdo it. You can go too far. So you have Pirkei Avos, which keep you back in check. You have the ethics of the fathers, which you learn, give you a bit of wisdom, so maybe I'm overdoing it. It's completely balanced, 6 months and 6 months. Now, what happens? Why are we doing all this? We said, listen to this, we said that now when each girl's turn arrives to come to the king, who's the king? Who's the girl? The soul. When each girl's turn, reread it, when each soul's turn arrives to come to God after having been treated according to the manner prescribed for women stroke souls. What is the manner prescribed for souls? 6 months extraneous removal, 6 months perfume mitzvah application. Then you go and see God. For so was the prescribed length. Thus the girl came to the king, the girl, the neshama came to the king. She was given whatever she requested.
When does the girl come to the king?
Yom Kippur. 6 months and 6 months, but then you get the special night. You get one night where you get to be with the king. The girl goes into the private chamber of the king. And she can request whatever she wants. Anything at all. Anything. That's only if she's fit for purpose. If you've gone through a good 6 months or 6 months spiritually, if you've taken 6 months to look at what you need in your life and remove the junk, of which there is a lot, and then take 6 months to actively beautify yourself with cosmetics that God finds attractive, and then you go into his personal bedchamber, as it were, anything you want, you get. That night of Yom Kippur, you in one-on-one with the Bara Olam. Anything you ask for, open your mouth wide and he'll fill it. Ask for everything. I went to the Ukraine. I went with Mark and Johnny. There are a few people that went to Ukraine recently. And Mark, who's here tonight, spoke on the bus. And he said, you know, one of the things you should do when you're daven is to think big. Don't ask for small things. I would like, you know, a hamburger each day. Ask for, like, best steaks every day for you and all Klal Yisrael. Anything you ask for is given to you. Don't think small, think big. I want everything. That one night's your special night. You've worked for it for 6 months and 6 months. The soul's gone round a cycle. How do we start the morning? Listen, this, it is worth being born to come here to hear these words now. From the Zohar, you have to hear this. It is worth being born and go putting your mother through labour to hear what I'm about to tell you. She shrieked for this. Hear me now. You get up in the morning, what's the siddur? You make brachas to say thank you to Hashem for allowing me to be up for another day of life. Then you, just, I'm going to be right with you. Then you say korbanos, offerings. And what do you say? The first thing you say is the keel. You have to wash your hands to purify yourself. Cleansers, that's what it says in the Megillah. Cleansers! Then there's trumas hadeshen, the sweeping up of the rubbish left over from yesterday's activities in the temple. Trumas hadeshen. That's removing extraneous material. Then what do you say? Ketores. Incense, perfume. This is what your soul needs. Every, it's not just 6 months, 6 months. It's in a daily cycle. How do you approach the Creator? First things first, gratitude. Moida ani means I'm showing gratitude. Actually, means I acquiesce to you. I show full gratitude. First thing is gratitude. The next thing is clean your act. Clean yourself spiritually. Remove the extraneousness. Apply the oil of myrrh. Then beautify yourself with perfume to make yourself attractive for your husband. The husband of the Jews is Hashem. We're his wife. He married us under a chuppah, a full chuppah at Mount Sinai. The cloud was the chuppah. The luchos, the tablets, was the money, was the kesef kedushin. The shadchan and the ceremony was held by Moshe Rabbeinu. We got married. He's our husband. Beautify yourself for him. This is how to go about it. After that, how does the prayer continue? Then you go through to sing his praises. The girls went in and they sung. They sung music. You know, that's what they did when they went in. They had a band and anything they wanted was given in. There's Machlokas Rashi and Ibn Ezra that they were allowed any musical instrument to bring in. Or Ibn Ezra says anything they wanted. A trapeze act, anything. Just impress them for that one night. Anything for that one night. Because that one night was going to be different between them living in a harem for the rest of their lives or actually being the empress of the known world. 127 provinces. They literally, they brought in a circus and zebras. I want zebras. I'm going to have an African theme. Bring it to them. Tell the chairman, I'm going to need zebras and giraffes. Bring in the zebras and giraffes. And they brought them in by plane and had zebras and giraffes. She did a trapeze act. Ta-da, you're going to like me. I'm fantastic. We sing Pazuke de Zemra. We sing verses of play. And then we go into the king with an Amida, with a standing prayer, one-on-one. It's the exact same system in your siddha. Six and six. Oil of myrrh, and then cosmetics to beautify yourself for the creator. Who'd have thought that a bunch of women going to a beauty parlor for a year in ancient Persia, in ancient history, would be written and encoded as a guide for the soul to endear itself to the creator? Would you have thought that? Maybe not. I think now we can understand my eavesdropped conversation on the two Kabbalists on the street corner of Jerusalem. How you doing? Well, you know, it's tough in the months of myrrh. He's onto it. He's onto it. We now, in this very month, are leaving the months of myrrh and beginning the months of cosmetics. That's where we at in our own soul cycle. That's what we're doing. We've left pretty much the end of Adar is the beginning of Nisan. And Nisan, you're busy with Pesach. Now you're busy. You don't have time to sit and think about what's useless in your life. You've got to make Yontif. And there's a lot to do. So that's that. This guy was saying he's been working really hard in the months of myrrh to look at what's useless in his life, what he's focusing in his life, which is actually holding him back. There's a lot in each of our own lives that we can look at of things that we focus on that are not completely necessary. They just aren't, and they are taking up too much time, energy, and resources. I remember an amazing thing that I heard, it's falling into my head. There's like something falls into your head, you've got to say it. I heard at a Shabbos Agadol Drasha, Rabbi Osher Westheim Shlita, and he said, I don't know how a person can work out what tzedaki he is or going is or is not going to give if he isn't paying full school fees for his kids. If you've worked out with your school to not pay full school, you've got to work that out. That's extraneousness. Anything, you've got to get, the most important thing is the most important, building your family. Put it on you, that's important. Worrying about whether or not you're going to have a little leather cover to your gear stick without any special stitching isn't as important as educating your family and getting yourself ready for your lives. That's the month of myrrh. It ends this month. I very much hope that all of you have gained an insight in two ways. One is practically the myrrh cosmetic changeover in your own personal lives. There's what to learn from here. Another thing is who on earth would have thought that's what it was talking about when it talked about these maidens going in, having 6 months and 6 months, then going to see King Ahasuerus. We just whiz over that in the landing of the Megillah. Get to the harems, that's the fun bit. Whoa. All you need is a chumash and a Megillah Esther. Everything else is in there. Two psukim tell you how to live your life. Two psukim. Next time you see two psukim that don't make sense, I would like you to think about this evening and say, you know what? Maybe there's more to it. Maybe I ought to do further research. Maybe I shouldn't write this off as utter nonsense. Because it probably isn't. People, it has been an honour to be able to address you this evening. I'm going to stick around for about 5-10 minutes to answer any questions. But apart from that, I wish you the most wonderful, uplifting and cosmetic next 6 months that you can possibly have. Thank you so much for allowing me to address you. Have a wonderful evening.